Welcome to the Advanced Sports Analytics Show here on RotoGrinders, brought to you by Jock Market. Stop throwing your money away. It's time to check out Jock Market, the app where daily fantasy becomes a stock exchange. Buy and sell shares of players in real time for real money. Download now for a 100% deposit match up to $50 using the promo code GRINDERS. And get this, if you don't turn a profit this week, Jock Market is running back their first market guarantee to cover your losses in week two. So download Jock Market in the app or play stores, or check out Jock Market, Jock, JOCKMKT.com, and use the promo code GRINDERS for a 100% deposit match up to $50 on your first deposit. I'm Jordan Cooper, back for another week of the Advanced Sports Analytics Show with Stuart Gibson from ASA. The last week, if we talk a lot about correlation and leverage strategies on this show. If you pulled the leverage wheel, that lever, you know, all the way down, you said Antonio Callaway, Elijah Moore. Hey, if you're 3K and you're not Jalen Waddle, I guess, maybe, I think he was the only one. And if you just slam that down and you said Kyle Pitts, okay, get out of here. You know, that lever, if you broke the lever off that leverage thing, you probably did pretty well. Unfortunately, I didn't slam it enough.
Yeah, likewise. I had a good bit of exposure to, those cheap 3K guys. I mean, some Waddle in there, but also, you know, plenty of lineups wasted on like Callaway. Rondale Moore, I guess did fine, but like a lot of Elijah Moore. I think probably a little too spread out across some of the different quarterbacks. You know, I had exposure to a number of different guys. I think Lawrence was probably the guy I was most overweight on, but, you know, some Fitzpatrick lineups, you know, dust, you know, a lot of Josh Allen lineups, just nothing. All in all, not a great week, but, it's just tough. You know, these first weeks can be kind of discouraging when you open up the season with a losing week. I know for us, we're incorporating some new stuff into our projections and simulations, and never good to come out of the gates with a negative week. But gonna continue to trust the process here and move forward to week two, and hopefully get some better results here moving forward.
Well, my week two is my favorite week because of small sample size syndrome. People take the first week and say, that's exactly how the teams are going to play. And that doesn't necessarily need to be true. How do you take into account, regressing that first week data where, you know, you're still taking, we have the, you know, Najee Harris played 100% of snaps, right? Darrell Henderson, 96% of snaps. Like we see what the teams are going to play. Like, how do we know if that's going to continue or that first week was an aberration? And how do you kind of put that together? Because your priors for some of these things may actually be the opposite of it. Do you just average it out in the middle? I mean, how does that process work on tailoring those projections so that you have a little bit more sense of if the trend is going to continue, or it's much better to account for historical data more?
Yeah. So I guess what you're referring to there is mostly like volume type stuff, right? Like shares of rushes or targets. I think kind of the most common approach is taking the average of our prior, essentially what we projected for week one, and what occurred. Probably that is the most, I do every week go row by row, player by player, and kind of look at what we had projected last week, how it actually played out from a share standpoint, and then kind of decide on what to expect moving forward. Yeah. And like I said, most common, probably taking the average, but, you know, also trying to incorporate stuff we know about the coaches, like, you know, Damian Harris, I think was a tough one to think about this week. Like, you know, he had a huge rush share, pretty good target share, I think usually higher than we typically see with him. You know, Bill Belichick, I think of as one of the more mercurial coaches when it comes to how to manage the backfield. I would say we've projected Harris as of now pretty aggressively. San Francisco, like, of course, the Mostert injury shook things up in a way that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily expect. to be shaken up moving forward. But like, you know, where they are, where there are instances of kind of coaches who have at times been somewhat tough to predict, I think erring on the side of the prior makes sense. Like, I don't know, to me, Najee Harris feels like a guy I feel pretty comfortable with, you know, reacting aggressively to what we saw, because we know Tomlin and the Steelers, when they have had, you know, a good bell cow running back that they like, have been inclined to kind of give a bell cow role to whoever it is that they like. And then I tend to think, like, with rushes, those I think you can trust with a little more stability. Like, rush share are coaches intending to, and offenses, you know, I'm sure there's quarterback kind of audibling at the line of scrimmage. Like, these are designed intent to get a specific player the ball. As we're with target share, like, I think there is some variance in target share. You know, look, maybe Anthony Schwartz and KJ Osborne are going to be close to 20% target share guys for the rest of the year. But like, at least at the outset, my inclination would be to not believe that to be the case. You know, there are going to be guys who, you know, we project conservatively based on kind of early season usage. And, you know, maybe we're wrong. Maybe KJ Osborne, like, is, you know, a legit wide receiver three that is going to be a portion, you know, a significant portion of the offense. I think, at least to me in the outset, I would rather be wrong on being over conservative on Osborne and therefore over aggressive on like Justin Jefferson or Thielen than I would really the other way around, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, I view it from a market perspective. Like, I personally don't try to predict whether or not, like, the one game sample is real or not. I just tend to play whatever the opposite of the market is. So, like, in certain cases, the market is like, oh, Najee Harris, 100% of snaps. Well, what happens if Benny Snell has 20% of the work? I mean, like, what if you know, Daryl Henderson, Sony Michel, because it was his first week on the team or whatever, that's the reason why he didn't, you know, he got one carry. Like, but if the field is going towards a certain spot, if the field is going to go, I got to play Cedric Wilson because Michael Gallup is out, and I'm going to treat Cedric Wilson like he's Michael Gallup, I'm more likely to ignore that and go, well, I think people are overreacting to the injury. Then the KJ Osborne, it's like, if no one's going to realize that he got like 8 targets last week and he's going to be 2% owned, like, I'll bet on the fact that, you know, that maybe that is the new normal. So to me, it's, I know in your situation that you're trying to actually project ranges of outcomes. And for me, I'm just playing the game as DFS from a theory perspective of, I'm just going to hope that the market is inefficient and they're overreacting in whatever way they are. Because if KJ Osborne is 18% owned this week, I'd be thinking the other direction. I'd go, okay, well, it looks like people think one thing, like with Eli Mitchell. Like, Eli Mitchell is going to be in that kind of weird 9-10% range where I think there's a lot of the field that is underreacting, going, oh, there's no way that's sustainable, right? The Shanahan's going to run with like 3 running backs. And then some of the field is like, well, what happens if they just like Eli Mitchell and they run him at the 85% of the plays? Well, that's a probability that happens also. So to me, I just weigh, if the market's over in some direction, I'm just going to be the opposite
of, yeah, that. And to some extent, I mean, we're talking about two different things, right? Like, if we take KJ Osborne, for example, like, I'm kind of looking at it, at least in my prior discussion, of the approach of, yeah, trying to project, trying to make a projection for him. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, I'm likely to play or not play. I might kind of just let the simulation and the, you know, the ownership that we have assigned to him, figure out whether or not, you know, he's a guy that's going to fit into my lineups. As I'm looking at it now, looks like we have like some slightly negative kind of leverage metrics on it. So my inclination would be that he probably won't appear in too many of my lineups. Doesn't mean that he wouldn't appear in any, but it's kind of hard to say who's going to appear in the lineups, you know, before Sunday. But yeah, no, I get what you're saying, right? Like, if, you know, he's going to be projected a certain way and you're going to kind of have an interpretation of whether that projection is strong, accurate, and kind of weigh that relative to how you think other people will roster him, or the rate at which you think other people will roster him and make make a decision if you think people are over aggressive or over conservative, I guess, in assuming, I don't know, that he is an 18% target share guy or that he's not an 18% target share guy.
Right. That's what we do on the show. We talk about leverage. We talk about correlation. And when it comes to correlation, I mean, someone asked in the YouTube chat, I believe last week, that I talk a lot about projections. We trust projections. All the stuff that you'd be looking at throughout the course of the week, like that you see, you know, all the shares, all the matchups, all of that type of data, like is already factored into whatever projection set you're using, or if you're building your own model, like that all is accounted for, including like Vegas totals are included in that also. But yet we still on this show talk about the high total games. I explain it that when you're correlating players together for GPPs, like we're not aiming to get the game that hits its total. We're looking at the game that's going to go substantially over its total. Like we're looking for a game that goes for 60, 65, 70 total points. And from historical data, I mean, I'm assuming you have those correlation metrics, that the higher the team total, the more likely that game as a whole, which means multiple pieces from that game, end up being the highest scoring, you know, players on the slate for GPPs.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like fantasy points by and large come from, or at least are correlated to real life points. So naturally, you know, you're going to want to target the games with higher points, but like, you know, there are other considerations. I mean, price sensitivity, of course, like, you know, if there's the highest total in the game, but all the players are, you know, cumulatively, you know, I don't know, 30% higher than kind of the next highest game, like, you know, of course that is significant and salient and something that you want to factor in. You know, we talk a good bit about like the density of scoring on teams. You know, I think like Seattle is a team that I know liked last week and typically like, because they are condensed, right? Minnesota at times, definitely last year, you know, condensed fantasy scoring. And like, yeah, there are teams like the Colts, for example, that frequently have respectable totals, but they're so, disparate in terms of where you can expect that fantasy production to be distributed to, like that has to be factored in. And, you know, I do think we do try to do a decent bit of talking about that on the show. I mean, as far as like, you know, it sounds like maybe this person was alluding to just like looking at game totals on Sunday as like a guiding metric for teams that they want to stack. Is that?
No, the opposite. More the fact of, well, if the game totals and the team totals are already reflected in the players' projections, like, why do we care what the team totals of the games are? But the point is that, like in a 45 total game versus a 55 total game, like a 45 total game may still have a guy that scores 38 points in it, but it's less likely to have three guys that score 38. Like if we're correlating our lineups, we're building game stacks. Like if the game is a 45 total and goes and comes in at 50, like the likelihood of four players from that game giving you ceiling scores is less likely. You want 70. You want a game that's 38-35. And the games that are more likely to put up those types of scores are the ones that are higher totals, only because you're building multiple players from the same game. If you didn't care about correlation whatsoever, then I would agree with that person of, well, if you're building a cash lineup, who cares what the totals of the game are? It's already factored into the projections as the medians.
Yeah. And I think just, I mean, functionally from a show standpoint, sure, we could go by games with highest cumulative, you know, projected fantasy points per dollar, but I think that would be a confusing show format. So,
right. Well, that's why a lot of times we throw in that at the end, right? We go through the highest total games and then we go, is there anything else that's on the board that, you know, from that perspective, maybe worth looking at? And you know what else is worth looking at? If you're playing on FanDuel, sign up for the DFS OG's FanDuel contest. That's a contest where you can compete with Beer Makers Fan, Head Chopper, and Notorious. And it's a good payout structure. I believe it's single entry. So if you're playing over there, enter that now. There's a link on the homepage on RotoGrinders for you to sign up for that. And as always, like and subscribe. Give me those thummy thumbs on the video if you're here on YouTube. And if you're on the Daily Fantasy Football podcast feed, feel free to give us a rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. So on this slate coming up on Sunday, we have 13 games, five with a total 50 plus. And we're going to start with overwhelmingly the chalkiest game on the entire slate. It is the Cowboys at the Chargers. It opened at 52. Now it is a 54 and a half total. Chargers with an implied total of 29. Cowboys 25 and a half. And if I go to our current ownership in lineup HQ, not including the quarterbacks, Eckler 17%, Allen 20%, Cooper 14%, Lamb 16%, Zeke Elliott 17%. I don't think we have to like argue that the pricing on some of these guys is a little bit too low. And I don't think we have to argue that this is if we didn't have to factor in ownership, this would be the best stack on the entire slate. But once we factor in ownership, is there a way to stack this game in some regard that that other people will not be doing? And I also have a question for you when it comes to the running backs, that is the hedge on game stacks necessarily Eckler and Elliott, being that they can also catch passes? So do you view that, is a weird way to play the stack by playing a running back in the stack? Or, I mean, I'm just looking at this going, it's hard to ignore this game, but is it, even at these prices, is it the type of game where, oh, it's going to be high on, let me just X out the whole game? Because I still think some of these players could hit their ceilings, even if the game goes under, and we may still have one or two guys that end up in a GPP winning line.
Yeah, I think like my preference would be is just to take one of the high value receivers as a one-off and try to stack elsewhere. Like, I mean, like you said, the projectable value for really the passing game on both sides, you know, quarterbacks and really the three primary receivers is phenomenal. I mean, it's hard to debate that, but like the ownership, especially on the Dallas side, like Dak, Lamb, Amari is just going to be insane. You know, when you factor in ownership, I kind of have negative grades on the Dallas, you know, side of the game. Again, not because it's like a bad value or bad spot or anything, but, you know, just I think the ownership is going to be hard to combat. I think you make a good point about, yeah, potentially the running backs not being like phenomenal leverage. I mean, Zeke's just like a guy I'm just not like that excited to play.
But it's not like he's going to go unowned. I mean, like naturally I would go, okay, everyone's in the passing attack this game. Let me play Eckler or Elliott. And it's like, oh, okay. They're still one of the two higher owned running backs on the slate. We have Mike Williams priced up a bit to 6,100 that we're not normally seeing. So I think he'll be lower owned. Jared Cook will be, you know, that's an option on the Chargers side. Cedric Wilson will still get some ownership as a, you know, a 3K type of punt receiver. Maybe the tight ends, Schultz, Jarwin. Like, to me, I'm finding it hard to build stacked lineups with the Cowboys, especially. But even Herbert, like Herbert's going to be one of the, like, both of these guys are going to be the two highest owned quarterbacks on the slate. So, like, the instance is that if Herbert doesn't get there as quarterback one, if Prescott doesn't get there at quarterback one, is it possible for more than one player from either side of the game to be wide receiver or running back one? Like, should I be playing secondary correlations of like Eckler Lamb or Allen Cooper or Zeke Mike Williams? Like, is that worth, like, if those two guys, if the players on each side of the game get there, like, and put up 30 plus points. It's one of those situations very similar to MLB DFS, where it's like you're taking a higher owned guy from a five man stack. But of course, if like that guy gets there, it's more likely that like the entire stack gets there, which you don't even have because you just have that one guy. So I need to consider, whether or not, because it was very similar to last year. There was this Cardinals game last year where I said it was Cardinals Bills. And I'm like if Diggs and Hopkins get there, the stack gets there. So like, why am I playing them like as a secondary against each other? I think that's a little bit less than that because those teams have like really alpha wide receiver ones. While these teams like between Allen and Williams and between Eckler and Elliott and between Cooper and Lamb, like I think there's enough combinations that like two of these guys can get there and some other quarterback, some other stack, you know, Russell Wilson, Kyler Murray, Tom Brady, you know, other stack gets there that I'm like, I'm not sacrificing like the equity, the relative value of my lineup by playing like a chalky one-off CeeDee Lamb and a chalky like Allen against him and just hope that like the quarterbacks are just not the ones that get there.
Yeah. I mean, well also like you mentioned, there are numerous high total games. Like there are routes to, you know, eat Keenan Allen or Cooper or whomever, you know, being wide receiver one and, you know, maybe Dak or Herbert put up good, but not great games, or maybe they put up great games, but you know, one of the other, eight quarterbacks from those other 450 total games exceed them in value or, exceed them in kind of raw production. I think it's like a tough game to just X out completely because the value is so phenomenal. But yeah, from a stacking standpoint, just because the quarterbacks are going to be popular. And I think like, I just think they're going to be highly, highly owned stacks as opposed to like, you know, Adams last week, who is, you know, going to be like a highly owned one-off. I think maybe just taking a piece or two from the game. I tend to prefer the wide receivers, Keenan Allen and Cooper. And you know, you can make a case for Mike Williams or like Jared Cook as well. I feel like Jared Cook just kind of as a tight end probably makes the most sense when paired with Herbert, but you know, take a Keenan Allen or Mike Williams and, you know, try to stack through another game that you think maybe has a chance to beat out this game, even if, you know, the game, even if the LA Dallas game as a whole kind of doesn't fail completely, you're kind of just putting a bet on another game, just equaling or bettering, this game in terms of kind of fantasy production.
How about the opposite? How about like, maybe not for large field GPPs, but smaller ones, just overstack it. Just, I have a lineup that I built to overstack this game. You could play Prescott plus Zeke plus Lamb plus Cooper plus Cedric Wilson. And then on the run back, you play Allen, Cook, and Eckler. And then you play some other defense. So like, if this game is 45 to 38, like, who says, now for large field GPPs, I think now you're getting to the point where, you know, the players are, you're now negatively correlated to one another. Their ceilings at least. But, you know, for like a 500 entry contest, like, could this be the type of thing where like, why don't I just play all the dudes and just like, if this game goes over, like, I don't have to worry about where it goes to. I'm just going to get it all.
Yeah, that seems feasible to me. I admittedly don't play a lot of like sub 1000 contests. So I don't have really a great feel, but I see where your head's at and like that could make sense.
Only because it may be different. I'm the only reason I'm saying that is just like, why would you overstack the chalkiest game? Like my style is to like, just not play it at all type of thing. But it's like, well, I think a lot of people, this is going to be the most owned stack, even in small field, but I don't think they're going to play everyone. And it's like, feel free to try to get as many points out of these one-offs from other games with your stack. And I'm just going to be like, well, if Cedric Wilson takes down an 80 yard touchdown, it's like, well, I'm going to beat out lineups that have Cooper and Lamb and no Wilson. But then if Cooper puts down 100 yards, I'm going to have those. Like, I'm just going to have all the points. If Zeke falls in the end zone twice, like, I have those points also that those other teams don't. Like, I'm leveraging myself against all the other stacked lineups. The only caveat is I need the game to go over. And if the game is 20 to 14, like, I'm at the bottom and going, waving at everyone above me.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, traditional two with one bring back would lose anyways. It's almost like not only is it a bet on this game, but it's kind of a bet against the other games, or potentially betting against other players' like ability to pick the right pieces from the other games should they go off, which, you know, is a fine way to go.
Right, just ways to think about this game. I wanted to cover this game the most because it is by far it's the highest total and by far the most popular game. The next highest total is only 1 point below it. And I think we're both going to like this game. It's the Seahawks at home against the Titans. It opened at 52.5. It is now up to 53.5. The Seahawks are a 6.5-point favorite, 30 implied team total for the Seahawks, 23.5 for the Titans. These are two offenses that are fairly condensed. Okay. I mean, I take a look at ownership here just so we can get a sense of that. And I also like the fact that like all the best games are also the late games. If I just look at outside of the quarterback, Chris Carson is going to be the chalkiest player in this game, which is a running back at 17% or so currently in our RG ownership. AJ Brown, 10%, which is respectable, but not a high-owned wide receiver. And then everyone else in this game is low. Lockett, 6, Metcalf, 3, Julio, 2, Derrick Henry, 6, Ferkser, 4. With Carson being the higher owned piece of this game, doesn't this just scream out to play like a 3+1 of either Wilson plus one of Lockett or Metcalf plus like Disley or Everett, you know, something like that, or you play Tannehill plus AJ Brown plus Ferkser, like that type of stack on the other side with neither of the running backs as the run backs, but like AJ Brown or Julio Beckton. To me, it almost screams out like at a 53.5 total that this game could be a shootout.
Yeah. No, I think it looks like a great spot. It is, I think, potentially going to get underowned just because of the popularity of that Los Angeles Dallas game. And yeah, I mean, with Carson looking like the, you know, highest owned kind of most probable player. I think the lineup, you know, builds itself. You know, and I like both these quarterbacks and passing attacks. I think like last year and even last week, you know, I do wonder, I don't know. I feel like people are pretty sharp and aren't going to like totally discount AJ Brown after kind of a dud of a week one. But yeah, I mean, I think you could do this from both sides.
I have a question, Stuart. My main question in this game is the secondary. I have a feeling, I'm just going by gut here, you have the data, that Chris Carson's ceiling game does not correlate well to shootouts. Like if Chris Carson has a 3-touchdown game, is it less likely that playing like an AJ Brown or Julio Jones on the other side is not as useful?
Yeah, that would seem likely. I was going to ask you kind of the counter to that is, like, I wouldn't be open, I don't think, to like a Tannehill, Brown, you know, maybe a second Titan plus Carson, but would you at all be open to like Russ, Lockett or Metcalf and potentially a cheap second Seattle guy and then Henry on the bring back? I know historically Henry has had decent positive correlation with, like, I think a Henry ceiling game doesn't exclude a possible like Seattle shootout ceiling game the way that a Carson ceiling game does. I do think an interesting component, I mean, yeah, rather than take the Seattle running back, take the Tennessee running back, rather than take the Seattle running back, add the Tennessee pass catchers and throwers. I just feel like you have kind of a setup for a really well leveraged build and lineup on kind of multiple accounts.
No, I agree with you on the fact that the way that Seattle plays versus the way that Tennessee plays, that if Carson is touching the ball 25 times, this game is under. Derrick Henry is more likely than Chris Carson to score in a 60-yard touchdown. Like if Tennessee is up by 2 touchdowns on 2 long Derrick Henry touchdowns, then Seattle's throwing the ball more. So like I'm much more likely to play Henry in that type of configuration than Carson. The only issue I have is that it's Russell Wilson, 7,500, Tyler Lockett and Metcalf for the 7K, Derrick Henry's 8,000. I mean, just from a price perspective, that you're playing an $8,300 running back in a stack that is already over 20K as it is. So it's like you're very heavily dependent that all the production goes that way, and you better make sure you get the right Seattle wide receiver right.
Yeah, you certainly are getting up there in price. I do think the conventional way would be to go with Brown instead of Henry, but I don't know. I mean, we've seen in the past Henry can be one of these guys that just breaks slates and can pay off seemingly insurmountable price tags, and expect him to have pretty low ownership this week, mostly on account of that high price tag. He's the most expensive Titan, not the most. It looks like there's some other running backs ahead of him.
Right. But, yeah. We got Kamara. We got Cook. We got McCaffrey. We got stuff.
But like those guys will be popular, right? So like if you have Henry by default, you're not going to have, Kamara, Cook or McCaffrey. And it sets up to be a very, very high leverage spot.
I think, Stuart, I'm more likely if I play Henry, as a secondary. So instead of playing and paying up for Wilson and having a quarterback slot at that high, I think I'm more likely to play Henry plus Metcalf, Henry plus Lockett, something like that, and then pay down. Like that would be a type of lineup where I'm playing a cheap quarterback type of stack, and then I'm getting the secondary there. Because, it starts getting absorbent at that point. I think it's more likely that if Derrick Henry has a 3 or 4 touchdown game, I don't know if Russell Wilson is quarterback one, and at 7,500, like I need him to be quarterback one, but like a $5,500 quarterback, I don't need to be quarterback one. He could be quarterback four with 24 points in a cheaper stack. And then I still get my, 30 points out of Metcalf and 35 points out of Henry. And I think I'm good.
Yeah. One thing I like about this game is I like the tight ends. I think tight ends always a tough position to figure out. And one approach that I think we talk about a decent bit is just like play the tight end of the quarterback that you want to stack. I think both Firkser and Everett are unlikely to generate a ton of ownership. And I think both have solid enough projections such that, I feel pretty good about going like quarterback, their tight end, the best receiver, of course, with Seattle, you kind of have to pick between one of two and then bring back the best receiver on the other side. I mean, it just seems like a stack that kind of builds itself. I'm with you. I like this game a good bit.
Okay, let's go to the next game. It's 52 total. It is the Falcons at the Buccaneers. It opened at 53. Now it's at 52. The Bucs are a 12-point favorite. They have a 32 implied team total. The Falcons with a 20 implied team total. We take a look at ownership. You don't see much here. Yeah, Godwin, 11. Ridley, 9. Pitts, 10. Evans, 6. I mean, I don't see much of Ronald Jones, 5. I don't really see much. Where's Fournette? Fournette, barely anything. I mean, for a game with this high a total to have this low ownership, do you think it's primarily because, they're 12 point favorite, the Bucs, and Brady, Brady has a ceiling, but it's not rushing ceiling. The problem is that spin the wheel, the wide receiver roulette wheel and choose which one's going to do well. He tends to spread the ball out, right? Gronk could get there. But the prices on these guys are not exorbitant. Godwin 6,600, Evans 6,100, Antonio Brown 6,000, Gronk 4,700, and the running backs are cheap. I don't think it's in the worst way to double stack Brady with two wide receivers. You just make sure you get the two ones that produce and not the one that doesn't. I think the ownership is spread more because of uncertainty, because it's not a condensed offense and not because a 32 point total team is a bad team to stack.
Yeah. I think it is one of these games, and Tampa Bay has kind of been this way for a while, where it's like, yeah, the game total looks solid. The receivers, I think, are like really good values in this game. I mean, Brown at 6,000 looks really strong. Evans, I think, you know, is going to generate relatively little ownership, you know, on account of kind of a poor week one, but, you know, maybe people are, I mean, I think people will likely be fairly sharp on him. Yeah, it's just tough to figure out. It's not a game that I want to like load up on and just kind of, you know, be like a flag plant type of game, but definitely think it's going to make sense to get some exposure to this game. You know, Tampa Bay, even though it is going to be the most difficult to predict, still to me kind of feels like the side to be on, just because there is better value among Tampa pass catchers. So yeah, I think a game that I would like to be a little bit overweight on, take my shots. You know, of course there's a chance that, you know, there's of course a chance the game fails. And there's also a chance that the game hits, but I just don't kind of piece together the right combination of players. But look, I don't know. I mean, I feel okay about taking shots on good sides, even if they're kind of less than guarantee that, or less than a full guarantee that the game going over ensures kind of a strong lineup performance. Do you see it that way, or are you kind of inclined to stay away from these clearly good spots that are, you know, potentially scattered performance?
Right. I just go by the ownership. I mean, I like the ownership in this game. I almost, it's kind of weird for me to say, I almost wish that this game was higher owned, because the running backs for the Bucs are cheap. Ronald Jones is 4,800. Leonard Fournette's 5,100. The team has a 32 point total, and they're favored by 12. Like, if you look at the historical data, as far as correlation is concerned, running back fantasy performance is very tied to the total and the spread of the game. The question is that who knows which one of these guys? I mean, Arian said, oh, Jones is the starter, but who knows what that means? He could play the first snap and then never play again, right? It could be one of these things, but like, I wouldn't put it past against the Falcons defense that they give up 4 rushing touchdowns. I mean, like, but I would gain so much more if the passing attack was more owned. So it's like, it's one of those things where I think the passing attacks for these games, for these teams, are under-owned, as well as the running backs are under-owned. So I think I'm more likely to do the sprinkle with this than stack it. Cause I don't think I don't think if you're playing Fournette or Ronald Jones, that you don't even have to play anyone else in this game. Like, I think if the Bucs are rolling with their rushing game and they're getting success, I don't think Ridley hits a ceiling. I don't think Pitts hits a ceiling. I just don't see anyone else hitting a ceiling. If Ronald Jones and Fournette have 2 touchdowns each, well, the touchdowns of the wide receivers go away. So it's like, it feels to me that especially in GPPs where I want to get cheap touchdowns at running back and pay up for stud wide receivers, that's primarily my type of build. If you listen to Brandon Adams last year, he's a very big fan of those types of builds, cheap running backs and high price wide receivers. This seems like the type of play. I mean, other than the fact that it's scary as hell to roster Ronald Jones and Leonard Fournette, how do you get away from the fact that there are 32 total and a 12 point favorite?
Yeah, I think it is hard to get away from that fact. I think the uncertainty is scary.
And they're not owned. And it's not like they're like 12% owned. I mean, these guys are sub 5% owned. And I mean, I don't want to be the one that's touting these running backs, because I don't like putting Ronald Jones in any roster, but I think in general, this game is going under owned. The problem is that, like, which way to stack it is the hard part.
Yeah. So how, like, I'm curious to know, and it's potentially a longer discussion than we have time for, but like, yeah, the scariness, the uncertainty of kind of where likely fantasy production is to go. How do you justify like, considering stacking this game versus just taking one-off pieces? Cause you know, trying to pick the right one-off piece, or, you know, even like kind of secondary, 1v1 stack, you know, is equally, kind of at risk of not hitting, whether or not you're going the one-off route or the stack route. I don't know. I'm kind of interested to hear your thoughts.
I think it's all based on the quarterback. Not to get into a longer conversation, is that once you put the quarterback in your lineup, you're kind of betting, especially if they're over 6K, you're betting that their quarterback won. So you have to think in terms of, if Brady is in the lineup, how does Brady turn into quarterback one? Now, on the distributed amount of how he distributes his passing, it's quite possible he's quarterback one without any receiver being in the winning lineup, right? I mean, the way that he interacts with the team. So if I were to play, I feel like I could play Godwin, Evans, or Brown by himself without Brady as quarterback one, right? But if I play Brady as quarterback one, I don't mind playing two of them. Like at that point, can I pick the right two? Well, if the rest of the field is going to go away from this game because they feel uncertain, I'm just getting more relative value by taking a stand. Look, I built lineups with last week with Russell Wilson, and I said, here's one with Lockett, here's one with Metcalf. I had more Metcalf lineups. Turns out Lockett was the one that won. I mean, you just, at some point, you just have to make a choice, right? I'm more likely to probably side with Godwin than Evans or Brown. But I mean, it's not like any of them are going to be that owned that I really care that much about the ownership, because I think Brady is not going to be a high owned quarterback in comparison to Dak and Herbert and Kyler and Russell Wilson even, and stuff like that. So like to me, it's the lineup as a whole. Like if I'm going to play, like for instance, if I'm going to play Dak in a line, let's say I play Cowboys, like I don't mind playing like just a one-off wide receiver of Tampa or anything like that. But I'm less likely to if I'm playing Brady and I have a choice between I'm playing Brady plus Brown plus one of Godwin or Evans. I think if Brady's in my lineup, I'm much more likely to play the second Bucks wide receiver than my first Cowboys wide receiver. Right? Because once I put the Cowboys wide receiver in, I'm actually giving points to Dak Prescott lineups that I actually need to fail. I want Brady to put up 36 points as QB1. And for him to do that, he could support two receivers. So it's kind of like thinking about all the lineups that I'm competing against and how they get there. So my Brady double stacks are probably more likely to have Zeke Elliott in it or Eckler in it than my lineups that don't have Brady in it. Then if I don't have Brady in it, then I could play CeeDee Lamb. I could play Amari Cooper. Does that kind of make a little bit of sense?
Yeah, that does. It sounds like it is, you're thinking about these whether to consider games a stack, one-off, or potentially both, is potentially conditional on the other games and kind of other scenarios that you are hoping to play out for one or the other kind of type succeeding in the context of the slate.
Right. That's why, like, if you use Lineup HQ here at RotoGrinders, which you can get if you're a premium member, click on the link in the description, get $10 off your first month. Start building chalk lineups to see what they look like. So it's like, these are the types of lineups, if you don't play these guys, that you're going to have to beat. So it's like, what is negatively correlated to the Cowboys passing game? The Cowboys running game. What's negatively correlated to that? Like, so it's like, if you're going to say that Tom Brady is the quarterback one, you're saying that the Dallas passing game doesn't produce Dak as quarterback one. So what is negatively correlated to that? So that would be, I mean, you could do that for any slate, any game, kind of trying to put those pieces together, but you kind of have to know what the chalk is going to be in order to do that. And one game that is not going to be chalk, another high total game, is the Cardinals, the Vikings at the Cardinals in Arizona. It's a 51 total. It opened and it's still 51. The Cardinals are a 3.5-point favorite. Cardinals with a 27.25 implied team total. The Vikings with a 23.75 implied team total. Looking at ownership in this game, Dalvin Cook, 13. Hopkins, 12. Edmonds, 8. Thielen and Jefferson, 3 and 4. Rondell Moore, Osborne, not much. AJ Green, nothing there. I mean, is this game going under? I mean, to me, this seems like I mean, the only problem is that like a lot of pieces of this game are high priced, but I mean, Arizona runs at like the fastest pace. Kyler Murray has probably the highest ceiling out of any quarterback. Why aren't we playing Murray plus Hopkins plus Thielen or Jefferson, especially if the Vikings are, I mean, the Vikings passing game is going like virtually unowned.
Yeah, I guess probably, you know, from a median standpoint, like Kyler Murray is a tough projection just because he's so expensive. But yeah, like you said, I mean, probably him and Allen, two highest ceilings on the slate. You know, Hopkins per dollar, maybe not, you know, the highest ceiling, but from a raw standpoint, I mean, got to be one of the highest ceilings on the slate. Yeah, it just becomes expensive if kind of you think about doing Murray plus Hopkins plus say Jefferson. But I don't know. I've been in favor of equally expensive kind of trios of players. Not you know, recently on the show even. So
right. You literally, you know, like, why don't we play Russ Wilson and Metcalf and Derrick Henry together? Isn't that good? It's like, hey, what I'm saying is actually cheaper than that.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it makes sense. Like, you know, Murray, you know, this is a spot where he's just not going to be super owned relative to kind of other spots that he's in. From kind of a number standpoint, neither of these sides are popping as kind of strong plus EV, but like from a, you know, just eye test, like, yeah, to me, it makes sense. I mean, maybe you could make the case that like Arizona's passing can be a bit spread out at times. But I think like I would rather get Kyler than Kirk Cousins. So at least to me, it seems like the approach should be probably Kyler plus like Hopkins plus, you know, keep it simple on the Arizona side and bring back one Minnesota guy. Is that how you're seeing it?
You don't have to keep it simple though. Hear me out on this. What do you think of this? Kyler Murray is a rushing quarterback. So, I mean, like, so he could score two touchdowns on the feet. DeAndre Hopkins at 8,000, like, could get a bunch of yards, right? Let's say he has 130 yards on eight receptions. That's still 21 points. That ain't bad. But I mean, Kyler Murray, if let's say he throws three touchdowns and one's to AJ Green, one's to Chase Edmonds, one's to Rondell Moore. Like, all these guys are really cheap. So why can't I play Kyler Murray as a single stack with one of the cheaper guys? And Hopkins still has a good game. It's just that at 8K at wide receiver, there are other wide receivers that, you know, end up outscoring. Hopkins has 22 points and still is not unnecessary. But Kyler Murray has 40. Either Moore or Green have 16, but they're under 4K or below, and then you run it back and one of the Vikings wide receivers has, you know, 130 and two touchdowns, like, and it's so much cheaper. And then now you're able to fit in like secondary correlations of other games better in the rest of your lineup. Do you have any data on Murray as far as how correlated he is to like the secondary guys versus Hopkins? When we're talking about kind of like 75th percentile, like when Murray scores over 30 points, like how correlated he is he to the wide receivers, or is his ceiling just primarily rushing?
If you give me like, I don't know, 2 minutes here, I could pull that up.
Is it at least what I'm posing like a valid thing to consider because of how Murray scores points?
Yeah. Oh, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, him and probably Lamar Jackson, and I guess Jalen Hurts as well, are probably the few quarterbacks that make sense as kind of a single stack piece. Or I'm sorry, as like a, I guess you're not proposing him naked, but rather just like with non-Hopkins.
Right.
So yeah, I think it makes sense to me. Let's see. I am curious to see kind of the Kyler correlation with, you know, I guess really Hopkins and some of these other secondary pieces. Right, pretty much,
I could understand, Stewart, that Kyler and Hopkins at the 50th percentile are quite correlated. It's just more of that, like at the 80th percentile.
Yeah. So I'm looking at it now, like of the guys currently on the roster, and we don't really have any correlation with Green or Rondale Moore, because you can't have correlation until you have three data points. But yeah, Kirk, I mean, historically has had slightly better correlation with Kyler. And, you know, the combined max that, you know, I think is one, you know, it's kind of two ways you can look at correlation, right? The correlation metric, kind of the R value, which is useful, but like you touched on, you know, sometimes you can have guys like Hopkins and Murray have strong correlation, positive 0.448, but their combined ceiling is only 72 fantasy points is where the combined ceiling of, or the combined max. So that is, it's not like some hypothetical, you know, combined max that we're projecting. It is in a game, what is the most points that Murray and Kirk or Murray and Hopkins have combined for? The combined max of Hopkins and Murray is only 4 points higher than the achieved combined max of Kirk. So to me, like that type of stuff does signal kind of what you're talking about. It probably wouldn't make sense to try to do a screen share kind of mid show. But yeah, I mean, if you look at a chart pretty much of Murray's production versus Hopkins, you see a straight line up to essentially 30 points for Murray. And then, you know, it's not like when Murray gets to 40, Hopkins is getting to 40, like the Hopkins max kind of tops out around 30, you know, which is fine. You know, you'll take like a 4X from Hopkins for sure. But the correlation, if you plot the data points out for Murray versus Kirk, maybe I can post it on Twitter, like in a comment to the, when this gets posted, but you know, Kirk Murray is just like a straight line, right? Like when Murray hits 30 points, Kirk has usually been living around 15 points. When Murray hits 40 points, Kirk is, you know, he's not getting up to 30 just because that's not within kind of his range of outcomes, but he's kind of continuing up. So I think what you're saying that the data would support, I definitely kind of after the show could post that to Twitter to kind of lend an example of kind of what you're talking about. Cause you are correct in kind of your guess there.
Okay. Let's go to the last game that has a 50 plus total. It's the games that we just talked about are all 4 PM games. This is the only game on the 1 p.m. Schedule that is 50 or over. It opened at 48. It's now 50. It is the 49ers at the Eagles. The Niners are a 3-point favorite, 26.5 implied total for the 49ers, 23.5 for the Eagles. If we take a look at ownership in this game, I'm going to assume to see very low numbers. Yes, no one over 10% owned, the highest with Mitchell at 9, Kittle at 7 or 8. Then we have a bunch in 4 or 5 range. It's a 50 total. You'd go, no one's going here. But is the fact that this game is, do you think that this game is actually harder to stack than the Buccaneers Falcons game? Because San Francisco, you know, Samuel, possibly Ayuk. We don't know what's going on with him. Jimmy G doesn't throw the ball that much. They run the ball a lot. Then we have a rushing quarterback for the Eagles as an underdog, and they have multiple receivers. They have Rieger. They have rookie Smith. They have Goddard. I don't know if Ertz is going to play, but like Kez Hopkins is out there, or Watkins, whatever is out. I mean, is the fact is that like, yeah, if no one's on this game, I'd love to stack it. It's just like this is, they're cheaper, but it almost feels like this game could go over and like no one gets there. Like it could be one of those games that we saw with even the 49ers last week of like, other than Deebo Samuel, like, yeah, the 49ers put up a ton of points and like still the stack didn't pay off. And not, and other than one player, no one got there anyway.
Yeah. I mean, the Eagles are like the Buccaneers and that they're spread out, but like Hurts is unlike Brady in that the Eagles as a team, you know, could kind of overachieve their team total, and it could just come through Hurts' legs, you know, and like there's no guarantee that, like, I feel pretty comfortable that if the Buccaneers overachieve, it's likely going to be to the benefit of the passing game. It's just kind of tough to pin down who are going to be the beneficiaries. With the Eagles, if they get there, I think it's far from a guarantee that it is to the benefit of the passing game. And then even if it is, it is equally difficult to pick out kind of the beneficiaries there. I don't know. I think probably not a game I'm going to want to stack up. I don't really go with naked quarterback builds, but like, I guess if there was any game that you would consider doing it, probably naked Hurts makes the most sense. In general, though, I think a game that I would be inclined to stay away from. It's odd. We have like kind of, decent grades on the San Francisco side. But I think it's just coming from like next to no ownership. I mean, really the other kind of peripheral variables, the rate at which San Francisco stacks would get inside the top 1%, the ceiling and kind of mean value of San Francisco stacks are all abysmal. So, I'm not sure if just like the simulation caught like a good, kind of variance in the simulation went favorably for San Francisco, because kind of all their underlying metrics as a team look not ideal for stacking, really quite bad. But per simulations, the San Francisco stacked lineups did have a positive ROI. But literally everything else kind of looks terrible. So when I see that, I'm inclined not to trust, small sample, positive ROI, everything else looking terrible.
Okay, now let's look at other games that have under 50. I personally have a game that I'm eyeing as a plus and a game that I'm eyeing as a minus. Okay, so that's what we're going to do now. So do you have a game that you're eyeing as a plus?
Yeah, I mean, God, shades of 2020, but like,
oh, don't tell me it's the Browns.
I kind of like the Cleveland side of Cleveland, Houston. Of course, kind of the most likely scenario is that Cleveland blows out, just turns the ball over to the running game. Don't have like super high ownership on any of the Browns running backs. I mean, Chubb, we have at 8%. I'm not sure. Can't imagine you guys having like super, super high. What if the Texans find a way to keep it close?
Mayfield, Landry, Cooks.
Yeah. Mayfield, Landry. I think like Peoples Jones, I think Schwartz is like the kind of flavor of the week in Cleveland,
questionable. He's questionable also. So he may not even play.
Schwartz's?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, so if he were to be ruled out, I don't know. Why not like Landry, DPJ, or even if Schwartz is in, has he been practicing at all this week?
I'm not sure. He's questionable. Okay. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Nonetheless. I don't know.
You're guaranteed, Stewart, you're going to have a Browns lineup.
Yeah.
I think if the Browns were a 7 million point underdog, you'd still have a Browns lineup every.
Well, yeah, I mean, then we know that they would be passing.
Right.
I don't know. I think, of course, they have like a strong team total. The fear, I think, will be that, it's all going to come through the ground. I don't know. Not that Jacksonville was like unpopular last week, but I don't know. I mean, look, we talked about it a bit last week, like comparing kind of the Texans to the Jets. Are they a team that is just going to be incapable of supporting competitive games and kind of production from the other side? Maybe I will be overreacting to their week one win against Jacksonville, but nonetheless, like I think if Houston keep the game close, like I do think Mayfield has a chance to be strong value with no OBJ. Like the targets are going to have to go somewhere. If Schwartz were to be held out, that would certainly make like Peoples Jones really compelling. As of now, to me, it looks like a side and kind of a stack that I'll have decent exposure to. And of course, I mean, it's going to be next to no ownership. Cause I think the consensus will be that, the game is going to go as people expect. There's also higher total games with kind of more compelling pieces. I don't know. I just think there's good value there. Super low ownership. It is a game that I kind of have a plus on for sure.
And my plus game, Raiders at Steelers. Najee Harris, most likely is going to be the highest owned running back, possibly the highest owned player on the slate. But let's just say that the Raiders go out to a lead. We just got news right now while we're recording that Josh Jacobs is out. So it's going to be Kenyon Drake and probably Peyton Barber. I'm assuming maybe Peyton Barber may even take over the Jacobs role, and Drake is just going to be Drake. But I think that's more likely to lead to more passing from the Raiders. I'm just going under the assumption that, like, if the Steelers get down, that just is all negatively affected Najee Harris, who's going to be high owned. So, like, I don't mind playing Carr plus Waller plus one of the plus Deontay Johnson plus Chase Claypool plus one of the Pittsburgh wide receivers. I think Waller is going to be more owned on FanDuel than he is on DraftKings. To me, it's not necessarily like it's not the best play from a raw point perspective or even a point per dollar perspective, but from a relative value perspective, as far as leverage, like if Najee Harris has a bad game and that game still gets to a 47 total, who benefits from it? It's going to be all the other pieces in the game.
Yeah, I'm with you. Looking through our charts, I have both sides of this game. Actually, it's one of two games where both sides per simulations have positive ROIs. We actually have Las Vegas stacks as the highest ROI, not projecting as a great like median or even ceiling value, but ownership should be low.
That's what I want to hear. I want to hear the Raiders on the top of your list.
Yeah. So, but that's interesting though. Like, to me, it would feel that, I mean, I guess if Jacobs is out, maybe Las Vegas goes pass heavy, even if they're winning. But like, let's see, like for a car, certainly a car ceiling game seems like it occurs when Pittsburgh is winning, which kind of coincide. I mean, it does coincide. You would most likely with a Harris ceiling game. So,
but I think if Harris has a ceiling game, the game goes under. If Harris touches the ball 28 times, I'm assuming that the game is Pittsburgh 21, Raiders 10. I mean, like that type of game. I think the only way this game opens up and Harris fails is if it becomes a shootout. And in that point, I trust Carr to throw to Waller 23 times and maybe play Edwards alongside him, you know, like do that, then play Ben Roethlisberger. Because I don't think the Raiders will get up to that much of a lead, right? Often enough that Roethlisberger has to throw 58 times. I don't think they want Ben throwing that much. But I think if the Raiders could take a lead, this game has like, it has, other than Harris, has like no ownership. So like, I want that scenario. If Najee Harris wasn't owned, if Najee Harris was 8% owned, I wouldn't even be talking about this. I just think that where can I find the game scenario that is negatively correlated to Harris? And I think the Raiders stack with the single Pittsburgh run back is the most likely. But there could be other, maybe it is a Ben stack. I'm just saying, like, I'd rather that side, but maybe I do play a Ben plus two and, you know, Ben plus Deontay plus Jake Claypool plus Waller.
Yeah.
Because it's more expensive. That's the only problem.
Yeah. The Pitt side feels very Tampa Bay-ish though at not as attractive pricing. And I would assume that you're kind of comfortable single stacking Carr with Waller, or are you trying to add like Edwards or Renfro? Or
I mean, I could. Edwards is cheap. I mean, all those guys are cheap. I mean, but I mean, if I play Carr, I don't think Carr gets to a ceiling without Waller having a massive game, especially in a tight end position where if I could win tight end with a 34-point game and the next highest scoring tight end is 10, like I'll take that over the wide receivers.
Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you to end on your minus a game that you would be under on compared to the field.
I guess I haven't paid super close attention yet to what the field is likely to do just because I'm kind of focusing on our stuff.
Because you want me to give you my minus instead?
Sure, yeah.
The Rams Colts game.
Okay.
For the simple reason, it's a 47.5 total. I don't mind the game. It's the Rams at the Colts. It's inside. Okay, fine. 25.5 for the Rams, 22 for the Colts. The problem is that on DraftKings, Kupp, Woods, and Henderson are both getting owned, are all getting owned. Kupp is going to be one of the highest owned wide receivers. Woods is still going to get like 8 or 9% ownership, and Henderson's going to be like 15 to 17. Like, how do I stack this differently? Like, that to me, it's like Stafford is actually the lowest owned out of the bunch. Like, people may go, oh, people are playing Kupp, people are playing Woods, let me play Stafford, let me just play them as a stack. And I just don't think you're getting different enough. Like, if I'd almost rather play those guys as one-off than play the stack. Or if I were to play it, I'd do it on the other side. You play Wentz, and then you still play a chalky Kupp, but you mitigate that ownership by playing the other side of the game. The only problem is, who the hell do you pair Carson Wentz with? Because they seem to throw to the 8 million people. I mean, running backs, it does. Like, it almost feels like if I'm going to play an LA player, I almost want to play Jonathan Taylor across from Kupp or Woods. And if I play Henderson, I almost don't want to play anyone else in the game. If Henderson gets 25 plus touches, I don't think anyone in the game gets a ceiling.
Yeah. We've got a positive grade on Indianapolis side, but I think you hit on kind of the key point is that they're very tough to figure out. Kind of a middling, slightly negative grade on Los Angeles. So that makes sense to me. I mean, I think we've already kind of talked about when looking through it, the game that I would want to be under on, and that's Philadelphia, San Francisco.
Even though that game is already like under, like compared to the field.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
But it's still one of the 50s that are under. You'll get used to what I on the spot introduced a new segment. So like yeah. Typically we just go like, can you find one that you like? But we never did ones like, oh, ones that people are going to be on that you don't like as much. But I just wanted to at least touch. If we didn't touch on that Rams game, I knew we would get angry comments of like, how do you not mention Woods, Kupp, and, you know, like higher owned guys that like, why wouldn't you be playing a Stafford stack? And I at least wanted to explain, like, I don't think you're getting it different enough by playing a Stafford stack since many people are playing these guys anyway.
Yeah. I'll tell you. So I mentioned that Las Vegas Pitt was the only game where both sides, our simulations had as a positive grade. That's not saying that they're phenomenal values, just saying relative to ownership when simulating it through stacks from both of those sides generated on average positive return. Of course, you can stack these games and kind of lose money. The other game that I said there were two of them, the other game that has positive grades from both side makes no sense to me is Chicago Cincinnati. I'm gonna have to go back and look and see maybe where that's coming from. Cause just, you know, eyeball test to me, that doesn't seem like it's gonna be it.
I think it's due to price.
Yeah.
I think it's, I mean, cause I mean, look, if Burrow, I mean, if you look at all those players on the team, Burrow, Mixon, all the three receivers, Montgomery, Allen Robinson, like they're not screaming values, but I think they're all at least a little bit underpriced. That like, if that game goes over the 45 relative to the cumulative price of the stack, and then you're able to jam in like the best plays everywhere else, I could see that being plus ROI.
All right.
I mean, it's not odd. A game that I'm going to be looking at, but I mean, I don't think it's as crazy. If you would have told me it was the Broncos Jaguars, I would say, yeah, I think you're crazy.
Yeah.
Or the Jets Patriots. Like, yeah, if you said, oh, the Jets Patriots, or like, yeah, yeah. I don't see how that works out.
Yeah, well, we've got a good grade on the Jacksonville side and a not so good grade on Denver. But yeah, I don't know. It's odd to me. It's not a game that I would have kind of pegged just knowing the teams, knowing the total. But I don't know. At this point in the week, kind of my approach is just to fill out the numbers, run it through the system, and kind of see where the chips fall. So I just thought it was interesting and of note that was one of the games where there seems to be, good strong support for it from a simulation and value relative to ownership standpoint. So that was.
And can people see those grades at advancedsportsanalytics.com?
Yeah, so it's not on the tools. We have grades at a player level, more or less like a leverage score, we have a leverage score, the rate at which players appear in the top 1%, appear in lineups that are in the top 1% relative to their ownership, as well as a simulation value, which is essentially just the ROI of lineups that feature each player. The data is large in size and kind of in a fairly convoluted program that is kind of difficult to port out. But in the Substack articles, publish a table. So like I'll be publishing the table that I'm working off of in the Substack article.
And where can people get that? You gotta learn how to promote your stuff. Where do people get your Substack?
Yeah,
free. I mean, I get it every week. It's free.
Yeah, it has been free, but that was kind of just a week one promo. It will be behind a paywall. I forget the exact URL, but you can subscribe to ASA. It's like some Substack URL, I don't know. I wish it was just substack.asa.com, but it's not quite that simple.
Let me give you a web developer's type of thing. You should create a forwarder under your domain name. So it's advancedsportsanalytics.com/substack and let it forward there. So you could then say, I got to teach people. We got to have a whole hour of, how to market your site type of show.
Yeah. I think I'm a little too busy with the code at this point to like, look at the marketing behind it. But, I would say Twitter is like everything we do, we try to, link off to via Twitter. So I would say that's going to be the best spot, a good starting point. And you can kind of go down the different funnels that you see fit. So I can plug our Twitter. If you just search Advanced Sports Analytics, it should come up.
Know your Twitter handle.
we changed it like a year ago, but it is AS Analytics DFS at Advanced Sports AAS. Analytics spelled out DFS. We were kind of late to the game. Like all the good ASA and whatever handles were taken. So I don't know. It's just we got wrecked by first mover advantage or disadvantage. So
right, and you can follow you. You can follow you're at Start Gibson. They stole the U from you.
Yeah, that's correct. Also late mover on Twitter. So also choosing from a poor set of possible handles. But yeah, Start Gibson. I don't really post that much from there, but I do have a link to the ASA Twitter in my bio. So that could also be an alternative way to get to the Twitter, of ASA, which could be a useful resource, if you're into that stuff.
And it's in my profile. Also, I put that I'm on the AS Analytics DFS show, and I was late enough to the Twitter game that I couldn't get Blender Head. Some dude in 2007 was able to, and that's why I'm at Blender HD. Instead. So for Stuart Gibson, for me, Jordan Cooper, that has been another edition of the Advanced Sports Analytics Show here on RotoGrinders.com.